I'm Christopher Leiden, sitting in on the reinvention of Johann Sebastian Bach with Paul Eli, who wrote the book on the musical genius whose gift keeps on giving. Also with Donal Fox, sitting at my piano. He has made his own brilliant career extending Bach into the vernacular of jazz. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. We've done many takes on the music of Bach over the years. But Paul Eli, this thrilling book of yours, if I may say, Reinventing Bach, opens up a whole new way of thinking about why so many great artists put Bach in a class and on a peak that's all his own. He wrote not just music, but the source code, in a sense, of music ever after. I think of it as something like stem cell music that 300 years later keeps growing new shapes, new limbs, new organs, so to speak, in the hands of Yo-Yo Ma and Bobby McFerrin together, for example, or the Beatles, or the movies of Walt Disney, and many others. Walk us through this idea that you've discovered or invented of why Bach is different.
We know Bach as an organist. We know him as a church musician. We know him as a composer of extraordinary keyboard music. We know him as a master of large-scale choral works like the St. Matthew Passion, like the B minor Mass. But in recent years, there's emerged the notion of Bach as an inventor, put forward by a scholar and gambist named Lawrence Dreyfus. And Dreyfus's argument is that not only did Bach write the inventions, but that an idea of invention that he took from the Baroque arts of rhetoric informed all his creative activity, that in everything he did, everything he wrote, his wish was to come up with a musical pattern that was sufficiently developed just well enough that it could be carried out or further executed by others. And initially this was a form of education. He wrote the inventions partly as music for his eldest son to learn on and to learn composing. He put them in a book that's now in the Yale Library, and I had the privilege to turn the pages earlier this year. And to see this book about half filled in with compositions by Bach in his own hand was the thrill of a lifetime. What was striking was that the other half was left blank, with the expectation that the son would go on and do compositions of his own. But as far as I can tell, Bach did more composing in that book than Wilhelm Friedemann did. In any case, so here's the invention, an idea, a foretaste of composition that then allows the composer, the musician, to develop it further. Bach had a great sense of posterity, and I think there's no doubt that he expected his music would be played after his death. The idea that it would be played on a piano in an apartment in Boston, or that it would be played on an early Moog synthesizer by Walter Carlos, or that it would be played or sung by the Swingle Singers, I'm not sure. You know, obviously he didn't anticipate those particular musicians, but his own practice suggested that he understood his music as being able to fall well or sit well on all sorts of his different instruments in different contexts. He moved a lot of pieces from one instrument to another in his own career. He would adapt vocal works for instrumental pieces, sacred works for secular pieces, and vice versa. And in a sense, that's just what's happened ever since. People have said, this is just music. I can be true to it, but also do it in my own way. I don't have to choose one or the other.
So he would not be surprised or shocked or outraged that the Art of the Fugue, for example, which is played on pianos, it's played in string quartets, is also played by four saxophones.
Not at all outraged. That's just not an emotion that I associate with Bach and his approach to music. He got angry over money. He got angry when he wasn't treated with sufficient respect. But about music, he seemed to have the attitude of let a thousand flowers bloom. I think the last 25 years of his life he spent as a director of music for four churches in Leipzig. And typically his biographers talk about the burden that he inherited of composing all this sacred music when he entered into the job. He composed three full cycles of cantatas in his first 3 years there. But as I understand it, this was an incredible opportunity for Bach. He had four different churches where his music would be heard and 50 or 60 fices to write for. The more opportunity he had to get his music out there, the better. Mm. And likewise, with the more opportunities for other people to play his work, the better.
He wrote these cantatas on deadline for Sunday. It was his sermon. And Craig Smith used to say, no question in his mind, that they were intended as sermons. But it brings me back to the question. You mentioned he wrote inventions to teach his son. But to teach his son what? Was it about music? Was it about harmony? Was it about rhythm? Was it about playing? Or was it something else? Was that a sermon too?
Donald, do you have an idea here?
Yeah, the inventions. When we start piano, a lot of other instruments, the inventions let us know about, of course, coordination with our two hands and technique on the instrument, but also opens up the world of harmony, how those notes against notes are constructed that work harmoniously, even though they're working horizontally. So that this line that Bach uses is repeated in the left hand. I think the listeners already listened to it. So you learn about imitation, you learn about, as you're playing this, as an instrumentalist, finger technique, imitation, then you start looking at the vertical structures. And Bach deals with all of those in such a high level that it opens up the world of composition, opens up the world of invention. That is, there's very little information on the page. If you look at the scores, there's no dynamic markings, a few little slurs. So it's saying, here's a blueprint. In that time, a period of Bach's time, improvisation was critical to the part of exploring and expressing yourself. Add something to it. So that's why I think it lends itself so well, Paul, to moving forward through the generations and the centuries that the music's been here. One is the ability that he was transcribing his own music, as you said, that he had his own Mukes synthesizer in the organ.
Right.
You know, and that there was that the information given was substantive. I mean, it's Bach's hand and language, but that he's saying, yes, come in, use your imagination, do something with this so it lives on.
Isn't there an implication here, Paul, that to be a parent, to train a child, is to teach him these things?
That's right. So the story of Bach's life figures into the larger story that's told in Reinventing Bach. And Bach had many children, and at a certain point, a boy child died in infancy. And it's usually supposed, well, people always had kids dying in infancy in those days. What's the big deal? But as I understand it, it's a profound loss every time for a parent. Not so long afterward, Bach wrote out the little book for Wilhelm Friedemann, his son, that included the inventions. The son was 9, and several things were going on here. Certainly his musical education and imitation and counterpoint in how to devise a musical figure that opens itself up to replication in a musical way, all those things he was trying to teach his son. But in a sense, 9 was the age of reason, the time when his son would be ready to start becoming an adult. Bach was profoundly aware of this because he had just lost a son a few months earlier. So there was a sense of gratitude in the presentation of this book to his son, saying, here is some music that I wrote for you to develop in your own way. That's essentially what our children do. We train them, but we have to be confident that they will work out those dynamic markings and so forth that you mentioned as lacking in Bach's manuscripts, and they'll do it for themselves. So in a way, then, Bach's sense of invention comes to inform the whole way in which we pass our heritage on from one generation to the next.
Fantastic metaphor there. Donnell Fox, what's the player's take on this organic energy inside Bach? And then what is it that he's teaching?
There's so many layers. I mean, when you start piano, after you get your basic scale, fingerings and so forth, you go to Bach because there's that music that's so grand, even on the surface, if it seems rather simple, that because it's using figures that are not too complicated, off of triads. you think of a pop song, you have these simple chords. Bach uses those same simple chords. But the way, I mean, here's an F major triad. This invention, which a lot of people know, starts off in that same triad. And so that opens up your imagination, saying, whoa, what can I do with just simple chords? One, four, or five, say, in the blues. You know, at the end of this, Bach has. No. Actually create a blues out of that coda of the Bach invention.
Do it.
Yep. Structure is there. And so as a young child playing Bach, also there's another thing we haven't really mentioned, and maybe in your book you talk about rhythm. We think of a lot of other composers after Bach, after the Baroque period, but something about Bach that rhythmically, in his structure, not just melodically, harmonically, is always an underlying pulse. You know? I mean, look at this bass line in this. This is from a prelude. Now, if I just add a little, I think you'll find it's interesting, and if you notice this, Paul, that almost all of the Bach pieces start with 1-4-5-1, or 1-2-5-1.
Let's hear it. As yeah. In notes of the scale.
Yes, so in D major, one chord, four chord, five chord. In pop music, you hear that relationship a lot. Very famous prelude. There's a thing called inversions and so forth, because it's a little more technical, but this is 1-2-5-1, same sequence. Would sound like this. So that lends itself structurally to do a lot of invention, reinventing, because the chord structure is very clear, and it opens up your imagination to say, well, Bach can take such a simple chord sequence and do so much with it. Let's go back to that D major invention, same chord sequence. Amazing. How about this one? One, four, and five.
So walk into that invitation to make something fresh, different.
Okay.
Reinvent it, if you will.
I'll take these simple harmonies. And we'll do little things with them from the Bach. And I'll keep sort of Bach structures so we'll hear that relationship. So.
Thank you.
Piazzolla.
A little tango. Is he inviting you to do things that Mozart doesn't, much less Beethoven?
There, what Paul was saying earlier about laying the blueprint, almost saying that he's writing the music, here's the information, here are some figured bass numbers. I have a structure here that's really clear, but if you have a better idea, my piece will allow you to go to the next level. As composers moved on from the Baroque era, when we get to Beethoven, and you look at the manuscript, there's a lot of information. And they're almost saying, you know what, we don't want you, I don't want you messing with my music. I'm not sure that, because less and less of the musicians knew how to compose or improvise. So I'm going to give you a lot of information. Just follow to the letter, please. And so it's harder to pull away, and it can get where it's not as organic. It's more difficult with the, you know, when you have with Beethoven, there's so many dynamic elements. There's not a lot of dynamic elements with Bach. It leaves you room. Whether I could play that prelude very softly, right? What kind of prelude? Or Glenn Gould. Beethoven's not going to give us that opportunity. Maestoso, brother, not presto.
The way you're explaining it lines up perfectly with the way I encountered Bach. I'm not a trained classical musician. I grew up with every kind of music in the house, really, except classical music. Johnny Cash and the Beatles and Simon and Garfunkel and church music and symphony band music. But what you mentioned about the pulse and then the sturdiness, if you will, of the left hand, those things together, hearing you and watching you play right now, I realized that what I first seized on when I came to Bach from pop music and jazz was the pulse, and especially the left hand, which is so rock steady but also so intricate and interesting. I realized when you play one of those inventions that it's really the left hand that I'm listening to. Mm-hmm. I think from what I learned in Music 101, say, about piano, the emphasis was so much on the right hand, but here that's a wonder in itself, a left hand of a Bach invention. And then what you say about the relatively little information, coming to Bach as a listener, let's say I have different recordings of the inventions or preludes and fugues, then to see the sheet music and the piece that I'm so accustomed to takes up a single page. It's just, it takes the breath away to think that a piece that intricate is represented in one page of notation.
That's a good point, because when we, I mean, you think about listening to the Baroque style music, which is pretty complicated, right? You're talking about left hand, there's counterpoint, different lines going, point note against each other. And when we get to Mozart and that high operatic, very expressive, but it is primarily in the melodic line and its development. And it's sort of supported, not equally necessarily, right, by this harmonic, where Bach, everything is equal, right? The melody, the bass line, which is also a melody, everything is really democratic in that way. And the music after Bach, a lot of the other elements became more subordinate, more just supporting of a beautiful melodic line, you know, like Tchaikovsky, soaring lines, but the orchestration's there to sort of support the melody, not interfere too much with the star of the musical composition.
Paul Eli, your book, Reinventing Bach, is in large measure a history of the reinvention of this music in the 20th century. And maybe one of your key thresholds is Albert Schweitzer recording the Toccata and Fugue in D minor in 1935. That was the first of many, and I want to touch on them. I mean, Glenn Gould reinvented this music. Pablo Casals, Yo-Yo Ma to some degree. And then it starts reinventing musicians too. I want to touch on sort of the great moments here. What did Albert Schweitzer want to do? What did he hear? How did he fill in the possibilities as they hadn't been done before? And what did it mean, 1935, fascism threatening the world?
So Albert Schweitzer is best known as a so-called medical missionary. He founded a medical clinic in present-day Gabon in Africa. He was also known as a biblical scholar. and had written a provocative book about the study of the historical Jesus. But he knew a great deal about Bach, wrote a book at another composer's behest about Bach, and then became associated with Bach because of the success of the book. He's working in Africa. He comes to London in 1935 and uses a series of organ recitals to raise funds for his medical clinic. And some of the pieces that he played were recorded in a church, All Hallows by the Tower of London. What Schweitzer was trying to do with Bach, more than anything else, I think, is give voice to the long legacy of Bach that existed prior to the age when technology was around to register it, to record it. He was born in 1875. There was a long tradition of organs and organ playing extending from Bach up to Schweitzer. And so when we hear Schweitzer, we can hear, in a sense, the way music was communicated from one generation to the next through teaching, through notation, all the ways in which the past was passed on before the age of recordings. So then Schweitzer enters into the record electronically, and now we can listen to a recording that's more than 3/4 of a century old and hear exactly the way he played it that day. Suddenly, there's this black disc you can take into your home, and you can hear the Toccata and Fugue in D minor at home. You can hear it by yourself. You can hear it at 2 o'clock in the morning or at 10 at night. You can hear it 10 times in a row if you want. You can hear it without any of the religious associations, or you can intensify those associations if you want. The music has been uprooted, in a sense, from the church context, but in a way that doesn't profane it. It opens it up to new possibilities.
Was there a political message here?
Definitely, as I understand it. Schweitzer felt that Europe had lost its way. Lost its way culturally, lost its way politically. And for him, Bach embodied the human values that represented European civilization at its best. So, 1935, the continent's already been racked by one war. Another is on the horizon. He feels so desperate about the European situation that he's moved his operations to Africa. And he's going to come back with Bach and, in a sense, be a musical missionary trying to help Europe recover the values that have been lost and that are under threat again as World War II approaches.
Meantime, on the other side of the world, in Hollywood, Walt Disney is scheming up the movie Fantasia, and that builds on the same music. How can this be? What was on Walt Disney's mind?
Well, Walt Disney, it's forgotten now, made his name through the combination of images and sound. He was really the first of the animated movie makers to bind tightly together images and the music. So he had heard of Leopold Stokowski, the conductor of the Philadelphia Orchestra, and vice versa. When they met in a restaurant in Los Angeles, it's hard to know what happened next, but they wound up deciding that they would make this movie Fantasia. It wasn't going to be called Fantasia, but Stokowski, who was a devotee of Bach and whose signature works were transcriptions of Bach organ music for symphony orchestra, said, "This is the title, and we've got to open with Bach." And Bach is difficult to open a movie with. It doesn't have characters. It's not program music. It's not narrative music in the sense that a lot of 19th century music is, for example. But Stokowski gets his way. He goes to the Walt Disney Studios and explains the Toccata and Fugue in D minor to the story men, who then take some of his language and express it semi-abstractly in the now famous opening sequence of Fantasia, set to a 100-piece orchestra playing the Toccata and Fugue in D minor. Mm. When you see it, well, let's put it differently. It's hard now to hear Stokowski's orchestration of the Toccata and Fugue in D minor if you've ever seen Fantasia and not see the imagery as you hear the orchestration. The two are forever linked to people who've had the experience of the movie.
Was Walt Disney or Stokowski in sync with Schweitzer's sense of a remedy here for a world in desperate trouble?
Not so much. Stokowski definitely had a sense of Bach as the great artist of all time and one that people really needed to hear, but he was more or less an aesthete. Disney ended up getting quite active in the war effort once Pearl Harbor, after the attack on Pearl Harbor, but 1939, 1940, he was having his first big successes with Snow White and then with Fantasia. He was like the Steven Jobs of his time, just obsessed with his own business and not so much with the state of the world. Disney really wanted it both ways. He thought that making a movie about classical music would be a way to claim for himself the role of a serious artist. He would get taken seriously in a way that he hadn't been to that point. At the same time, he had a great populist and commercial sense, and he knew that his audience was composed with many, many children, and so he did think that he could educate people through this movie. He thought of himself as a person like a person in the audience. You know, I don't know what music I like. I'm a little intimidated by this music, but if you present it to me in the right way, I like it.
Meantime, Pablo Casals is recording the cello suites and reinventing Bach in his own way. I want to share this comment from Pablo Casals in your book. It's typical of so many testimonies of musicians, but Casals said late in life, "For the past 80 years, I have started each day in the same manner. I go to the piano, not his own cello, and I play two preludes and fugues of Bach. I cannot think of doing otherwise. It is a sort of benediction on the house." What did Casals' reinvention tell us?
Casals was a cellist. He was the best-known cellist in his part of Spain while he was still a teenager, but he didn't know that the suites of Bach for solo cello even existed until he found the sheet music in a music shop with his father one day. It was the decisive moment of his life. There was extraordinary music by the best composer, written just for him, in a sense. No one else knew about it.
And Yo-Yo Ma built a career on him.
You could say. There were many cellists in the meantime. Casals, it's amazing. That's the opening of the first suite, transcribed for piano, and he played that for 12 years by himself before he went public with it. Mm. Then he just played parts of a suite, usually the third suite, in concert. Then he recorded part of a suite. Another dozen years passed. It wasn't until he was nearly 60 years old, having first come upon the cello suites at age 13, that he undertook to record the complete set. And the reason I think is that for him, they were the music of solitude. Here was music where you could be absolutely alone in direct communion with Bach, and that was, in a sense, diminished by an audience. And so he waited for a recording studio to communicate that sound of solitude in high fidelity before he entered them into the record.
Speak of two other great reinventors of Bach in our time, Glenn Gould, a Canadian pianist, and Yo-Yo Ma, the Paris-born Chinese cellist, inseparable from their performances of Bach. And in their cases, they both re-recorded their most famous recordings. Glenn Gould recorded the Goldberg Variations in the mid-1950s, and then again in the 1980s. This was an event of how he had rethought, represented, and Yo-Yo, similarly with the cello suites. What's going on here? In those two particular cases, Paul Eli.
Well, Donal mentioned that you never master Bach. You can measure your own life against it, that there's a personal journey that you're taking accompanying Bach or being accompanied by Bach, and that was certainly true for Glenn Gould and for Yo-Yo Ma. Glenn Gould's very first commercial recording in the United States was of the Goldberg Variations from 1955. He recorded some of the inventions in the same sessions and, in a sense, invoked the muse of invention by doing so, but became famous for the Goldberg Variations, made 50 records, played most of the other keyboard music of Bach and recorded it, and then new technology spurred him to revisit the Goldberg Variations. Mono had been replaced by stereo. Analog recording had been replaced by digital. There was now a director on hand who wanted to film him visually, you know, making a new recording of the Goldberg Variations. And the recording studio where he'd made many of his strongest records, 30th Street Studio in Manhattan, was about to be razed. So all these things came together and prompted him to revisit Bach or reinvent his own Bach once more.
Is it a different statement? Should I be able to hear the difference? I'm not at all sure I would.
I'm one of those people who came to the latter recording first. I think the difference is really pronounced, and it's in tempo, in the fact that he takes many of the repeats in the second recording that he doesn't take in the first recording. The second recording really sounds like a reconsideration. The first recording, He had played the Goldberg Variations many times, but somehow he found a way to communicate the thrill of discovery. You feel that he's figuring something out in the Goldberg Variations for the first time. The second recording is very powerful, but it's not about discovery. It's a contemplative record more than a discoverer's record.
Sounds like Henry James rewriting The Portrait of a Lady 25 years after he'd written it. It's not a different book, but it's a different feel. It's almost a different girl in the middle.
It's a very good comparison. Gould's last successful recording was his second recording of the Goldberg Variations. He died just a couple of weeks after the record's release in 1982. Because of that, it's seen as an epitaph or as a late work or as a summation. But it's conceivable that if he hadn't died, he would have done something like what Henry James did, going through his earlier recordings, redoing them for stereo, altering some elements but leaving other things alone. He was a very self-conscious artist, just the way James was.
Tell us the Yo-Yo Ma story. Recording the cello suites and then re-recording them with video.
So if Gould was the first classical musician, the first famous classical musician who'd essentially been formed by recordings, not just by recitals or teaching or notation, Yo-Yo Ma was among the first great classical musicians to grow up taking multimedia for granted. He had a cassette recorder. He was on, I believe, The Tonight Show in the early 60s when he was before the age of 10. He recorded the cello suites in 1982 in Manhattan. Years passed. He was famous. He was famous for taking Bach into all different contexts. He played Bach on The Muppet Show. He played Bach on Sesame Street. He played Bach in the Reagan White House. He played Bach in Times Square. He played Bach, this is later, in the fictional White House of President Bartlett on the West Wing. So in a sense, this was his way of reinventing Bach. He didn't radically alter his approach to the music. What he altered was the mode of presentation, where he would take Bach. And when he put together a series for PBS called Inspired by Bach, he re-recorded the cello suites, and he invited other artists to interpret the cello suites in their media with him. So Mark Morris composed a piece to one of the cello suites. The ice dancers Torville and Dean composed an ice dance that they used to accompany a cello suite by Bach. And Yo-Yo Ma recorded his own new version of the cello suites to accompany the program.
And then toward the end of Steve Jobs' life, he said in so many words that listening to Yo-Yo Ma play the cello suites proved at some level there had to be a God out there.
This to me was a great surprise. I learned it only when the biography of Jobs came out. So in the 60s or early 70s, Jobs had an acid trip that centered on the music of Bach. He was out in a wheat field in California with his girlfriend, and he saw the wheat waving back and forth, and he associated it with the music of Bach, and it's as though the whole orchestral piece was being conducted by the waving stalks of wheat. Years pass. He runs the Next computer company, and the way he introduces the Next computer is by putting it on stage and having it do a duet with a live violinist. He has met Yo-Yo Ma in the meantime. When he gets ill, he says to Yo-Yo, "Look, I want you to play my memorial service." So when Jobs dies, there's a memorial service, and there's Yo-Yo Ma playing the Bach cello suites. Thank you.
Shake this religious implication in Bach. You hear it all the time. I know lots of players who don't go to church but worship Johann Sebastian Bach. There's one organ player in Boston, a composer, who's a devout atheist, but he'll say, in so many words, there is no God and his name is Johann Sebastian Bach. Daniel Barenboim and lots of others refer to the Well-Tempered Clavier books 1 and 2 as the Old Testament and the New Testament. Endless variations on Bach as a kind of scripture. What do you make of all that?
There's no doubt that Bach was a religious artist. You don't commonly see people trying to explain away his Christian commitment or his role as a church musician. Serious people seem to understand that he was an ardent believer, that he took his role with the church altogether seriously and wasn't just doing it for the money or to support his family. But beyond all that, there's something about the music of Bach that enables us to talk authentically about transcendence. For me, it has to do, first of all, with the superabundance of Bach. There's so much of it. It's all extraordinary. The fact that there is so much of Bach's music, in my experience, isn't intimidating. It's reassuring. You know you'll never get to the end of this work, and there's no end of different ways of playing it, and there's something transcendent about that. And then there's Bach's confidence, and certainly other composers had extraordinary confidence in their abilities and in the order of the world, I suppose, but that's what I hear in the music of Bach, the utter confidence in the world somehow making sense, and in his music to be able to render that the sensibleness of the world in sound.
Do you want to go to that place, Dono?
That spiritual place, yes. I mean, he definitely, as a musician, I feel that spiritual connection. That's different from religion, per se. It's a sense of something greater than who you are, something, there are unknown qualities, quantities, but we don't have to label what they are.
But he would remind you that he did label it. I've seen reproductions of those manuscripts in which he's written at the top, Jesu Juve, Jesus help me. How much more religious could he be?
No, Bach's very religious, but I'm saying I can enjoy his music and play his music, and I'm not particularly religious because I feel the spirit of it, the soul. So, yes, I think it's important when you're doing the cantatas and the choral works because you look at the words, and he's really programmatic music in the way he's describing what's going on. But I was playing this beautiful, this is a transcription, right, from a flute sonata of Bach's, and gorgeous. So I'm feeling something there. It's a religious experience for me to play it, but I don't particularly believe in an anthropomorphic God. You know, I'm not probably in the same place that Bach was with it, but he's speaking to me somehow. I don't know. Maybe Paul can elaborate what that means. That this people, no matter what their religious interests are not, Bach speaks to them.
One of the old church fathers said something to the effect of, the glory of God is the human person fully alive. And that is something like what I hear in the music of Bach. You know this person is fully alive. He's touched bottom. He's been all the way to the top. He knows death. He knows love. He knows heartbreak. He knows patient suffering. He knows the determination of an artist to give form to something that that is eluding him, and on and on and on. And it's hard to imagine an emotional state or a way of being that isn't represented somewhere in Bach.
Have we accounted for the Steve Jobs sort of conversion by Bach?
Oh, I don't know what was going on in Steve Jobs' inner life, but to me, that comment humanized Steve Jobs as much as anything in that long biography, that this is a person who is bent on his own creativity. He doesn't have so much to say about the great wonders of the world, but when it comes to Bach, he takes a pause and says, the music of Bach as played by Yo-Yo Ma is the best thing I can think of as proof of the existence of God.
Paul Ilai, you write about players reinventing Bach, but there's also this sense in which Bach keeps reinventing the players. There's a special story that's close to my heart about Leon Fleischer, who lost the use of his right hand for many, many years. And, you know, it was one of the great mysteries. Was it physical? Was it psychic? Who knows? He got it back. Later, he made this recording, Two Hands, which I play night and day. And it begins with Bach's Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring, and then also the marvelous Sheep May Safely Graze. And about it, Leon Fleischer said, I played Bach's Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring. It is special music, mantra music, music that sounds as if it had the power to wash away all of the dirt and evils and complications of the world. It is very good for the mental health. It took me a long time to grow into Bach and to reach an understanding of the music and a feeling that I could play with what I felt it required. Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring is particularly healing. It requires an almost childlike simplicity, but it takes a lifetime's experience, I feel, to express it. Leon Fleischer had a lifetime of experience. What's happening here?
So Fleischer played Bach growing up. He has an amazing insight in the liner notes to that or another record where he recalls a piano teacher telling him that the way to hear a Bach chorale or a Scarlatti piece is to imagine a trumpet fanfare in a palace. And when I heard the pieces on the record with that in mind, they were opened up to me in a new way. So that's just one more instance of Bach being reinvented. If you compare this piano music to trumpet music, you'll really get to the bottom of it. Well, the reason he lost movement in his hand, and I hope I'm getting his story right here, is he was playing really fast, intricate works like Rachmaninoff with tremendous demands on the right hand. Decades pass, the hand doesn't work. When he comes back to some facility with his hand, he's playing work. It's not as physically demanding or as fast. That Sheep May Safely Graze and Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring, but the expressive demands of the work are still very great. And so this apparently simple music that many people are initiated to Bach through becomes the capstone to his very unusual career.
How do you understand his line about mantra music, childlike music, born-again music in a certain way?
Well, the more you think about Bach, the more you have to think about repetition and what repetition is. Bach repeats figures in all sorts of different ways. In the case of Fleischer, it was repetitive motion was what led to his hand injury. So in a way, then out the other side, he finds in this music of Bach that to some people is simple to the point of being repetitive, something that represents the experience he's had of getting his hand back. There's the expression of the English mystic, all shall be well and all shall be well and all manner of things shall be well. Fleischer has had a difficult life, being a one-handed pianist for half his career, but there's a sense of gratitude and of assurance in those two Bach pieces that seems to speak to his own situation and the gratitude that he feels. There's a sense that the music communicates the gratitude that he feels at having his hand and his career back.
He spoke of Bach as anti-terror music, and he famously declined a White House invitation in the Bush years because of the war in Iraq. Make that connection.
So back in the 30s, Pablo Casals recorded the Bach cello suites. Then he essentially went silent. He wouldn't play in countries where Franco's regime in Spain was recognized as legitimate. Recordings went where he would not, but his power to withhold his music was a political act. 70 years later, Fleischer makes a similar gesture. I won't consecrate your White House with the music of Bach while a war is on. That's an illegitimate use of this music, in his view. There's some pieces that I cannot play in certain places, and this is one of them.
Donal Fox at the keyboard, thank you. Paul Eli, thank you enormously for this extraordinary book. I always think of musicians sort of paraphrasing the Bible, saying, you know, we have all sinned and fallen short of the glory of Johann Sebastian Bach. But you've added something new here that I had never quite understood. Thank you, Paul Eli, for this wonderful book, Reinventing Bach.
Thanks to both of you, and this has been a real reinvention for me. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Donal. That's for you.
Thank you. Yeah, pleasure.
Paul Eli is a senior fellow with Georgetown University's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. Reinventing Bach is the new book that he's been unfurling with us. Donal Fox's Variations on a Bach Fugue and many other solo and chamber jazz works are available on iTunes and on CDs at Amazon. Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until listeners, that's you, feedback with comments at our website, www.radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lighton. Thank you for being part of the reinvention with us.